Great to have you along today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And joining us from Seattle is Leanda Haupt. She is an author and naturalist. Her most recent book is Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. And she has done a lot of work with birds over the years with Seattle Audubon, also raptor rehabilitation and seabird research. And but it's crows that are really the nearest and dearest to her heart, and we're going to find out why. Leanda, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, Judith. I'm happy to be here.
Well, you know, the book is really fascinating, and it's even more fascinating looking back and seeing that you've been writing about what are considered common birds and animals for over a decade now. And you really talk about noticing and appreciating a variety of urban wildlife, how those birds, bugs, mammals that we see frequently tend to get labeled not really wildlife because, you know, familiarity breeds contempt, perhaps. But you
Exactly.
also focus your study and your writings on crows. What is it about crows that really fascinate you?
Well, you know, I mentioned this in the book over and over that crows are not my favorite bird. And I like them and find much to be fascinated about with them. But I don't quite love them. They're two things at once. You know, on the one hand, they're an intelligent, beautiful, iridescently feathered native bird. A lot of people sort of conflate them with starlings and think that perhaps that they might be introduced species as starlings are or pigeons are, maybe because so many of the common urban birds we see, like pigeons, starlings, and house sparrows, are introduced species. But crows aren't. They're native in our landscapes. And so there's much to learn from them as birds, and particularly as intelligent birds and close to home nature. But at the same time, and kind of the flip side, and this is why my book titled Crow Planet sort of has two meanings. You know, on the one side, it's the fact that, you know, we're possibly our lives and our relationship to nature can always be informed by the presence of wildlife, no matter where we live. But on the other side, you know, it speaks to the idea of a planet, you know, our planet, where the rich diversity of species is threatened by habitat loss, and it in many places the beautiful diversity of species is being replaced by a few dominant aggressive species such as crows. So there's two sides to the presence of crows among us.
Right. And that was one of the things about your book that really fascinated me, is you do make a point of examining two different ways that crows' dominance in the urban landscape can be viewed. And one thing that you obviously point to is just because of their size and the fact that they're very social, so there are often several of them, and they're loud and raucous, it's hard to miss them. I mean, you know, the same number of, say, mourning doves would not have the same impact on our senses, I think. But one of the signs, one of the things that you point to is a sign that even though they are native to our landscapes, they weren't always this dominant, or perhaps they shouldn't be this dominant. But as you said, other native species have been squeezed out or are, you know, in decline instead of really flourishing. But I think you make a very convincing case for crows as a success story, not just of the crows, but of human and non-human interaction and mutual benefit. What are some of the elements of that kind of symbiotic relationship?
Right. Well, one of the interesting things about crows is that unlike most avian species, you know, the woodland species and even the desert species, the more sensitive songbirds, they can live successfully among us and amidst all of the concrete that we've created. In fact, if you overlay the human population growth in urban places or human population graph and the crow population graphs, they are almost exactly the same. They mirror one another almost exactly, which is really quite interesting. So one of the things that crows benefit from is our refuse. You know, we're tossing out food into the parking lots and into our garbage cans with their ill-fitting lids all of the time. And so crows have a relatively easy access to food with their omnivorous diet. And when you combine that with the roadkill that we're always providing on our many city streets, they've got it pretty easy in cities. in some ways. There's, you know, we plant street trees, which are perfect for their nests. We provide a lot of buildings, which create, you know, warmth in the winter, and they can roost nearby, and we create all these wonderful gathering places for them. So we've created a wonderful urban habitat for crows. On the flip side, like you say, they're even in cities, we have a lot of songbirds. Right now, outside my house in a Seattle neighborhood, there are several species of migratory warblers, but they are so small. And if you don't know what you're looking for, or you don't pay attention to such things, you might miss them. Whereas with crows, it's impossible to miss them. Anyone walking around the street, whether or not they have an interest in nature, where they might miss a robin or a hummingbird, they're going to see a crow. And you can observe them relatively carefully without binoculars. You often need binoculars to observe wildlife, including birds. And so I think they're a wonderful starting point if you just sort of take the step of wanting to pay attention to the nature, close to home nature. They're the perfect starting point for that because they're easy and they don't require any special knowledge or equipment. You can just sit yourself down and open your eyes and observe, and you'll be treated to a marvelous show.
Someone commented on Facebook, someone from here in Madison, do you ever see, not to you, but to people in general, do you ever see the murder of crows that hangs out around Music Hall in the law school that's right in the center of the UW-Madison campus? When I walk to the bus from the library, I almost always notice them doing something interesting. I really get a kick out of how they peer down on all of the bustle below them. And they really, you know, you really do get a sense that crows are not just there, but they're really there. They're watching us as much or more than we're watching them.
Well, you know, avian consciousness is an understudied field, but corvids, the family of birds that includes crows, jays, and ravens, is really helping, and crows in particular, because we have such close contact with them, are really moving us forward in the way that we think about the minds of birds. And there was a group of scientists out of Cambridge, and what they did was, or they're actually animal behaviorists and psychologists, and they combined a lot of different studies about crows and primates and concluded that crows have the same, what they call, cognitive toolbox as primates, including humans. And it's because probably of their complex social structure and the ways that they gather food and communicate as part of that social structure, they've evolved conscious abilities that are not typical in many birds who have to rely more on instinct for their behavior. So when you see these little sparrows, they might be, I think that they have more capacity, consciousness capacity, than we often give them credit for, but they don't compare to crows. And so what we see crows engaging in are things like causal reasoning. So I don't know if you saw the famous YouTube video of Betty the New Caledonian Crow.
No.
With the hook. Oh, so this is a wonderful one, and you'll have to check it out after the show, Judith. There's this New Caledonian Crow, and she was in captivity being studied, and they gave her a small bucket of food, and they put it down a plastic tube, and the bucket had a little handle on it, and she could not reach with her bill far enough down the tube to pick up the bucket. But they gave her a piece of wire, and she very quickly learned to fashion the wire using her bill and her feet into a hook. And with that hook, she could pull up the bucket. So this is tool use, you know, something that we were startled when Jane Goodall found chimps using tools. So to see a crow not only using a tool, but making one quite quickly was really amazing.
So the next thing you know, they'll be watching us at the ATM machine and then going and using our PIN number.
Yes, they'll be memorizing our PIN numbers. I can see that. But they do have. Yeah. They have causal reasoning. They have what we call flexibility in response. So instead of learning things by rote, as some birds do as they're growing up from adult birds, introduced to a novel situation, they can respond flexibly. They can sort of decide what to do. They have imagination and prospection, so the ability to sort of think of what might happen in the future and adjust their behavior accordingly. And we see all of these things when, say, I don't know if you've seen crows take a chestnut and drop it in the road and wait for a car to run over it. So that involves all of those things, causal reasoning and, you know, imagination and prospection. So they wait for a car to run over it so that they open the nut so they can get to the nut meat.
Well,
here
and
in
that's
the Pacific North.
That's fascinating. But the part of the story that really kind of blew me away was that you talked about how crows learned to do that. And so, yeah, I mean, that's incredible. They drop the nut, they wait for the car to come over and run it over, and then they pick up the nut. But what crows figured out, and I don't think I'm using that word in an anthropomorphic way, what they figured out was that in places with really heavy traffic, it was hard to get back out and get their nut. And so they were actually learning to wait with the pedestrians for the walk sign so they could get back out into the middle of the road and get there and retrieve their nut.
Right. And it's the crows in Tokyo that are famous for that. And I don't know of any place in North America that they've learned that trick yet. But right, they would actually, they'd drop their nuts and they would stand with the pedestrians on the side of the road and wait for the walk sign to go get them, which is absolutely incredible.
And, you know, I have to say, what I've heard of Tokyo traffic, maybe they've had to develop before other crows.
I was in Tokyo. I was even afraid to go into the road when there was a walk sign. So,
well, we're talking with Leanda Haupt. She is the author and a naturalist. Her most recent book is Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. And Crow Planet received the 2010 Sigurd Olsen Nature Writing Award and was also named one of the best books of 2009 by the LA Times and Seattle Times. And she is with us for about another half hour. So if you would like to join the conversation, I would encourage you to do so by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Erica Janik, our on-air producer today, will answer your call. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can also leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is The Larry Mueller Show. And Leanda, we actually do have some people who are waiting to join the conversation, so let's go to Kurt in Manitowoc first. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, how are you today?
Good.
It was an interesting sighting. I was driving down the road recently, and, you know, I've seen lots of crows eat carrion as I'm driving along. You never see any dead crows on the highway. But anyways, as I was driving and I came closer, the crow was there. It was there, and it finally flew up. And as I approached, a live turtle dove, a full adult live turtle dove, flew in the opposite direction. So essentially, I want to say I came along. I was the guardian angel of this turtle dove. And, you know, I mean, I've never seen anything like that before. I've seen crows eat everything except live critters. And I know that they get dive bombed because they raid nests, but I've never heard of a crow attacking an adult bird. So this poor dove got bushwhacked.
So it was basically hunting the dove, is what you're saying.
The dove must have been on the side of the road or eating some pea gravel or something like that. And, you know, Alfred Hitchcock was on top of this dove. So anyways, I'll take my answer off the air as to if they attack adult birds.
Great.
So.
Thanks for that call, Kurt. Leanda?
Well, Kurt, I think Kurt is right that is a very, very uncommon sighting. So what crows are opportunistic in their diets, and so they do attack and eat young birds, baby birds. I'm going to say baby birds. So one of the most horrific kinds of sightings that you'll see is, you know, here in Seattle, we have, you know, those jogging trails around lakes, and people carry their fancy jogging strollers and their lattes, and they've got their little kids with them. And then a crow will swoop down this time of year, a little earlier, and pick up, you know, one of the cutest little fuzzy yellow ducklings and fly away with it. And so horror on all accounts.
Isn't
right?
that what we call a teachable moment?
It is a teachable moment, but usually everybody is in just too much shock and alarmed. So crows do not help their reputation when they do things like this. But you can see what a nutritious morsel this would be for a crow.
Sure.
And as far as attacking adult birds, it's almost always in response. You'll see a lot of times birds like robins that are very aggressive in protecting their nests. You'll see a lot of altercations between crows and robins at this time of year, or crows and cardinals. Because doves have a well-earned reputation for gentleness, I've never heard of a crow attacking a mourning dove. I've seen altercations with pigeons and crows in response to competition for food in city places, popcorn or donuts or pizza. But as far as a dove, and attacking a healthy adult bird and actually pinning it to the ground, that's very unusual, and I haven't observed that before, so I can't speak to exactly what was going on there.
Great, thanks for that call, and I want to let people know that Erica Janik already put up the YouTube video of Betty, the New Caledonian Crow, on our Facebook page, so people can easily find that. That's the Larry Mueller Show on Facebook, and you don't have to be a member of Facebook to be able to find that. You can just Google Facebook Larry Mueller, and you'll see the link for that YouTube video of Betty, the New Caledonian Crow with her tool. So we do have some more people who would like to join in. So let's go right back to the phone, Leanda. Jan in Illinois has a question. Hi.
Hello. Have you ever heard of people somehow surgically or otherwise splitting the tongue of a crow, allowing it to mimic like a parrot?
I have heard of people doing that, and it's a terrible idea. It's very cruel. It can end in disaster for the crow, and perhaps emotional disaster for the amateur surgeon who's attempting it. But it's not necessary to do anything to the tongue of a crow in order for it to be a good mimic. Crows are among the best avian mimics, and they are oftentimes as good as parrots. So crows that have been raised with humans will imitate their human friends. They will imitate the pets in the family, the cellular phones in the family. Someone who did one of the seminal studies of crow vocalizations, the study is now over 30 years old, but it's still a touchstone. He said that the favorite thing that he ever heard a crow learn to say was, "Oh, my Lord!" It was in the house that it was in. It would call out at seemingly appropriate times during the day. But I've heard of crows learning to swear, and mimicry is a big part of the crow. It's not just when crows live with humans that they mimic. It's a big part of the crow social life. So what we have found is that crows will, in a way, sort of like human partners and human families and humans among loved ones, will sort of pick up the vocal tics of the crows that they're close to. So when crows are mated and they're monogamous, they'll pick up they'll take the vocalizations that might be unique to their crow mate and mimic those back to one another. So it's a way of pair bonding. Hmm. And it seems that they do that in family, crow families too, will have in sort of individual vocalizations that they use and mimic among themselves, which is, and mimicry also is not fully understood among crows. So that's one of the things that we've noticed that they use it for. But it also seems that they use it In our observations, it might seem that they use it just for mischief. You'll see in our neighborhood, we have a crow that makes a cat sound, and it seems to make the cat sound when a cat is walking by. So it seems like it's just pestering.
Just messing with them.
The
yeah.
cat, which I wouldn't put it past the crows. Who knows what's going on? But it does seem to mess with the cats. They stop and look all around.
They look around, yeah. Who's on my turf? Well, Susan in Bristol has had some experience with crows living with humans, I think. So let's go to Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Hello. Thank you so much for this splendid show. This is wonderful. I had a pet crow when I was a child, and my uncle, my favorite uncle, stole him out of a nest and gave him to me as a baby, and I hand-fed him and everything like that. And it was amazing the way that he could mimic, because we would caw at him, but he would caw back at us and sound just like us. I would put him on the handlebars of my bicycle and ride down the street with him, and he'd flap his wings while we were, like, riding around on my bike. He was one of the coolest pets I've ever had. But when I really realized that crows were incredibly intelligent, I was driving down the road a couple of years ago, and there was a crow eating some roadkill. And when I was getting ready to drive by, the crow just walked across the yellow line and then waited for me to go by and walk back.
Now, he went into his own lane.
How did that crow know that you only go this way on this side of the yellow line and this way from that side of the yellow line?
Wow. Leanna, what do you think?
Well, I think, I think through observation and experience, you know, the same way that they learn that here in the Pacific Northwest, instead of dropping chestnuts on the road, they're dropping snail shells on the road. And wait, so it's that kind of, you know, observation and experience. But I love Susan's story about her pet crow. And I hear from so many people that either they had a pet crow growing up or their parents told them about a pet crow that they had. Crows are relatively easy to raise, but I'm not, you know, suggesting that you go out and get yourself a baby crow. It's not legal in every state. If you have aspirations to crow, you know, having a crow as a pet, you should check with your local wildlife office and see what is legal. But, you know, it is one of those great ways of breaking down the sort of human-animal barrier, especially with animals like birds that we don't always consider to be conscious or affable or pet-like in the same way that we think of animals like dogs. Whereas, as Susan's telling us, and so many people that have raised crows or lived with crows know, they can be just as interactive as a dog can, and oftentimes smarter. No offense to the dog people.
Of course not. Leanda Haupt is an author and naturalist. We're talking about her most recent book, Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We are talking about crows, but also about the wildlife that is all around us, even in the most urban of areas. Leanda Haupt is our guest, author of Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. And before we go back to the phones, Leanda, I wanted to focus in on something that Susan mentioned about her pet crow, that the crow would ride on the handlebars of her bicycle. And you talk about how you've seen, and it's well documented, that crows play, that, for instance, in a windstorm, they'll kind of jump out into the wind to, you know, basically windsurf, and just for fun, not because they're trying to get anywhere.
Right. Crows, just like other animals like dogs and cats, when they're young, they actually play more, and people. But adult crows appear to play as well. And so it seems when the windstorm is a great example. It seems like when it's a windy day, and I think we've all seen this, when the crows aren't flying to go from one place to another, they're often just in the air swooping, and it appears to be just for pure enjoyment of flight. We're not positive that that's what they're doing, but it's possible. I had a friend who has a skylight in a room in her home, and she was standing in that room, and all of a sudden she heard a clunk, and she looked up, and a crow was on the skylight, and it slid from the top to the bottom, and she thought that it had fallen from the sky or was injured or made a mistake, and it just clunked and slid down, and she thought, okay, I wonder if it's okay, and she was going to run out and see, but then she heard a tap, tap, tap on her roof, and the same crow jumped on to the light skylight and did it again. And it did it a couple of more times before flying away. So it was actually playing on the slide.
On the slide.
Of the skylight. Wow. I have a crow. I know everybody has a crow story. And that's one of the fun things about talking about crows. If you're ever at a dinner party and it's boring, just bring up crows, because everybody there will have a strong opinion or a story of something that they've seen a crow doing that they'll want to share.
Maybe not the roadkill stories before dinner, but...
Yeah. Right, exactly. But there are many, many others. So my neighbor has a big cherry tree, and they have a stepladder that they just keep to the side of it for gathering the cherries. And I looked out one day and I saw a crow hopping up the stepladder, step by step by step. And when it got to the top, it's a lot like the skylight story. It flew down and it did it again.
Just for fun.
And we'll see. Just for fun, apparently just for fun. I mean, we know that play has an evolutionary role, right? In all creatures, including ourselves, that it helps us rehearse for real life situations. It helps us to develop intellectually and even emotionally, and adds calm and adds fun to our lives, but also gives us life skills. And so that's certainly part of it with crows. But just like, you know, humans that play for fun, it appears that there is something about that in crows. And what's really, really interesting about this in corvids and crows is that for a long time in ornithology and the study of birds, play was not considered a valid category of study because it was something that only the so-called higher animals did, with, you know, different kinds of brain parts that birds supposedly lacked. So it's the crows and the ravens that have moved play into being a category of study for ornithologists. So that's quite wonderful. And who knows what other ways we are going to move forward in our studies of animal and avian consciousness in coming years.
Let's go back to the phone. Roger in Wanakee would like to join in. Hi, Roger.
Hey, crows are neat critters. There's a couple different things. You know, blue jays are member of the same family, they got about 8 or 10 different calls, like one like a bell. Anyway, but crows are so neat. I read, they used to hunt them years ago, we don't anymore, but they can count. They've determined through scientific research, I suppose, whatever, with people would walk out to a woods. Let's say two people would walk to the woods, one would go back, and the crow wouldn't go near the woods to be shot. But if three people went out to the woods and two came back, the crow would be confused and then fly over the woods like nothing was going on. But up at Grandview, Wisconsin, there was a bar up there that overlooking the beautiful marsh. They had a pet crow. It wasn't legal to have the crow in the bar, and I didn't know the crow was there. Came in and sat down, and the cruel crow flew over and landed on my shoulder and scared the bejesus out of me. And the owner of the bar, the lady, said, yeah, the crow does that all the time. He knows that he's intimidating people and scaring them. He does it because it's fun for him. He also had a terrific amount of words that he could say in language. It sounded like a small child, and you'd swear there was a human in the bar. Turn around, and it was a crow.
Wow.
It was amazing, but you certainly don't have to split the tongue of a crow.
No.
Well, Leanne, I mean, that story that Roger just related is interesting because, you know, you talk about the crows not only coexist with people, but they really seem to want to be around people and enjoy that interaction.
Well, you know, it really depends, Judith. I mean, if a crow has been raised among humans, it can be very comfortable and even affectionate among humans. But if you are among crows on a street, even a city street where they're quite accustomed to humans, you'll find that they're very difficult to approach. They're very wary. They're very protective of their own physical security and especially that of their nest and young. And so we're coming into that season now where the crow young are on the streets and people, one of the questions people ask me more than any other is, why are crows dive bombing me? Mm-hmm. You know, and if we'll pay attention, we'll find that it's not something that goes on year round for the most part. It's a seasonal occurrence and it's happening now, not because they're, you know, mean or hate humans, but because they're protective parents. And unlike many birds, many of the songbirds like warblers or even robins who can make these small nests and hide them and enter and leave their nest quite secretively because of their size, you know, you've got crows, which are these, they're stealthy for their size. A lot of times there are crow nests among us that we don't see and we're surprised that they were there because, you know, how could something as big and bold and dark as a crow have all of this going on without our knowing? But for the most part, it's very hard to hide a crow nest, especially when you've got a nest full of raucous crow young in it. Mm-hmm. And so boldness is what they fall back on for protection. So they're very wary of humans, especially this time of year. And So yeah, it's more when they're raised among humans that they have that kind of interaction. And if there's a crow you're walking around and it actually comes and lands on your shoulder, like the crow in the collar story, it's very, very likely a crow that was hand raised. So it's probably not a wild crow.
Talking about their nests, which you know, it's not surprising at all that they would be protecting it. One of the things you mentioned earlier is that crows are easy to watch, but one of the things you also point out in the book is that crows are so intelligent and so aware of what's going on around them that if they think that you're watching them or if they know that you're watching them, they will actually try to distract you from where their nest is. And they'll, even if they were on their way to their nest, they'll take a little detour to kind of throw you off.
Right. They're very, you know, they're accustomed to us being around, and most of the year, it doesn't particularly bother them unless we try to approach too closely. But as I was saying, in this time of the nesting season and the young, now the young, at least here in Seattle, many of the young in the first nest are out of the nest and fledged, or they're very small. So there's a very vulnerable stage when crows are really wary. When they've got the nest and they've got the young that haven't left the nest yet, or they've got eggs in the nest, they will actually try to fake us out if we're watching them. So if they have a stick or some food that they're returning to the nest with and they observe themselves being observed, they'll fly somewhere else. And sometimes they'll actually fly to perhaps an old crow nest or something that, and they'll pretend that they're putting the stick somewhere else, or, you know, they will totally fake us out.
Look at me. This is really my house, really. Yeah.
Right.
And that's amazing.
It is amazing. But, you know, this is an interesting thing. When people raise crows, it's oftentimes, you know, if you find an injured bird or a bird you believe to be orphaned, which it probably isn't, the crows are probably still taking care of a healthy baby bird, that's even if it's on the ground. But when people bring crows in for whatever reason and try to raise them, they're very, very difficult to return to the wild successfully. Even if you see them out there flying around and they stop coming and landing on your shoulder and they seem to be, you know, going out and doing good crow things, one of the things that makes crows difficult to raise and then release is their dependence on the complex social structure of crows. And this speaks to their intelligence as well. You know, a lot of birds, you can just raise them and toss them out and they'll become birds. But crow, the birds that they're meant to be, you know, of, mm-hmm. they'll adopt species appropriate behavior. But crows, because their social structure is so complicated and they learn so much, they have so many different vocalizations and behaviors, and they share information about how to be a crow and how to find a mate and how to find food socially. When you put a crow out and it hasn't been privy to that crow, you know, the raising within that crow social structure, they have terrible problems, and they tend to not live very long, not even to mating age. Hmm. So that's one thing to consider if you're, you know, find yourself an injured crow and you think that you're going to rehab it. If it's probably better off trying to fend for itself.
Yeah. Jean in Appleton has something to add, so let's go to Jean. Hi, Jean.
Good morning. I came late to the program, so I'm not sure whether you have recommended this book, which I got out of Appleton's Public Library. It's called Corvus, A Life with Crows by Esther Wolfson. And it's a British woman, well, actually she lived in Scotland, who had crows in her house. And it's all about the things that she discovered working and living with crows. They actually lived in her home.
Hmm.
And it is a wonderful book. I read it about a year ago. I think that's when it was new. And the other thing I would like to say, in a previous home I lived in, we faced a woodland which was the roosting place of a huge colony of crows, and the nightly entertainment, and especially in the winter when the leaves weren't on the trees, was watching them come in and take their places on the roost, including all the acrobatics that they went through in deciding who was going to sit just where and who was going to be on top, and it would go on for anywhere from a half an hour to an hour until they got themselves arranged in the correct position. And the acrobatics that they did were absolutely fascinating. So, as you say, crows can be wonderful to observe. I do not like them when baby birds are hatching in other birds' nests, though, because they steal the baby birds and eat them.
Yes, we were talking about that point a little earlier on. But the book Corvus, are you familiar with that, Leanda?
Oh, yeah, I love that book. Esther's book and mine came out at about the same time. So occasionally they were reviewed side by side as in Orion. And her take is we're very like-minded. But yes, hers is more in response to raising crows. And it's lovely. So, of course, after you read Crow Planet, I recommend Corvus. And, you know, her other point about the roosts that crows form. So this is it's a seasonal behavior. So for the most part, you won't see crows gathering in these great flocks right now because they're on their territories that they've set up for their nesting and breeding. But as the young crows of this year grow and fend for themselves, the family groups will start joining other family groups and breaking down some. And instead of separating off, crows will join in larger and larger flocks until we see these huge flocks that, you know, when you look up at dusk, in autumn, sometimes you'll see numbers of crows flying to their evening roosts. And if you can find one of these roosts, as she was describing, it's really, or you live near one, sometimes they number in the tens, but up to the hundreds and even tens of thousands of crows sometimes in outside of urban and suburban areas. And it's not only fun to watch them settle in the evening, as she was describing, but one of my favorite things to do is if you can find one of these large roosts, and we have one here in Seattle near the University of Washington campus, and you can get there early while it's still dark in the morning and witness the crows waking up. It's a lovely spectacle. It starts out very quiet, and they start out waking up just as humans do, speaking, you know, not quite awake, haven't had the crow coffee, you know. So they speak in these little crow wake-up whispers, and it becomes, and it's just like in the evening before, too. They'll have gone, you know, moved from this sort of raucous daytime mm-hmm. crow behavior into this quiet and quieter kind of what I call pillow talk, sort of crow whispering. And then when you see the flip side in the morning, it gets louder and louder until they finally take flight into the day. It's just it's a wonderful ritual of, you know, the turning of light and the turning of day that we can observe easily.
Thanks so much for that call, Jean. We're unfortunately coming up to the end of the segment with you, Leanda, and I just want to make sure that we could talk, I think, about crows for hours. As you said, everyone has a story. But the book is about more than just crows. It's also, actually, as David Sedaris put it in a blurb on the book, about the pleasures of keeping one's eyes open. And you talk a lot about cultivating wonder and that sense of really observing and noticing things that could very easily go unnoticed. And there's just a very short passage from the book that I'd like to read, if you don't mind. You say, "We practice wonder by resisting the temptation to hurry past things worth seeing, but it can take work to transcend our preconceived standards for what that worth might be. In the disturbed urban landscape, this is particularly challenging. Unless we happen into a zoo or unless something goes badly awry, we are not normally going to see bears, cougars, or even deer. Without the hope of a megafaunal sighting to keep us on our toes, our watching must delve one layer or several deeper. This is one of the blessings of the Urban Nature Project. Without the overtly magnificent to stop us in our tracks, we must seek out the more subversively magnificent." And certainly many of our readers are blessed with living in, you know, gorgeous Wisconsin wilderness or up north right. in the woods. But then there are a lot of us, too, that are in much more urban places for the vast majority of our time. One of the invitations we issued on Facebook was for people to share photos of that common wildlife that's so easy to overlook. And someone posted a lovely little picture of, I think, probably her daughter with a little baby mouse in her hands that they had found living in a window box. And I think that there are things like that around us all the time if we just open our eyes.
I think that you're absolutely right. You know, we have this idea that we've heard that we have our children have nature deficit disorder, and I think that that's true, and that we need to get out more in nature, and I think that that's true. But if we go through our day-to-day lives believing that nature is something that we have to drive to in order to experience it, we are going to maintain and even deepen that disconnect from the natural world. So I don't think that urban nature is a substitute. I don't think it's enough, but I think that it's an essential and beautiful starting point, the awareness that we are surrounded by and connected to the wildness of life every day. And with just a tiny bit of effort, a little opening of our eyes, a little carrying of a notebook or just pausing for observation, we can enter into that connection and be enlivened and delighted by it.
And you talk about that one of the most important things human beings can do is to develop skills as naturalists, and that word naturalists often, you know, has this kind of 19th century connotation to it, where, you know, people were out studying things and bringing back specimens and things like that. But you really talk about some very concrete things, like maintaining a field trip mentality wherever you go. And you talk about having your small set of binoculars with you, even if you're going to the post office, because you never know what you might stumble across. And also just having, even though you don't really need all that gear, just having something like a notebook or a small set of binoculars keeps you in that mindset of looking for what's out there.
Right, exactly. And it sounds like sort of a psycho-spiritual law, you know, that, you know, you get what you put out, you know, the energy that you put out is what comes back to you. But Louis Pasteur, the great French scientist, also said that chance favors the prepared mind. And so I think that when you go forward with the expectation of seeing and observing and being rewarded by that, somehow you are given more to see. And I promise that that's true, and I hope that people will experiment with that mindset. And yes, I think that just arming yourself as – I love that word naturalist. I think that you're right, that it's a little bit old-fashioned, but I really want to reclaim it, that idea of the amateur, which means one mm-hmm. who loves. So you can be not a scientist, but one who loves and studies the natural world with absolute validity.
Well, we've been spending the last 45 minutes or so with Leanda Haupt. She's an author and naturalist, and her most recent book is Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness. There's so much more to talk about. I think we'll just have to have you back sometime. In the meantime, people can easily get to your website through a link on our Facebook page, and the site is Leanda Lynn Haupt. So that's LYANDALYNNHAUPT.com. And it's been a great conversation. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I hope you'll stay tuned. We're going to turn to foraging for wild food, talking with Sam Thayer in just a few minutes. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.